Now, aren't you sorry you said the good singers stayed away? We had to do that just to show you. Okay, that's good. We'll give you points for that. Hey, God is good.
All the time.
And it looks like a bunch of us decided to go camping this weekend or something. I don't know what's going on, but we'll find out tonight or sometime where we all are. I definitely wanted to emphasize the announcement about Vacation Bible School. Several things in there that have to do with that. We're running just a little bit behind our normal schedule. I've tried for 18 years to get you guys to go move further up. And what's happened is you guys are rubbing off on me. So next year, I don't know what I have. We may not do Vacation Bible School until after the advertised date. That could happen. But no, it's time for everyone that's planning on helping to get there by the charts. The big one back there by the water fountain that's just a kind of a job where you show up and you just, for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, you are focused on what's happening here. And then you can go home and kind of forget about it, okay? It's that kind of a job. But it's just manpower, woman power, teen power, whatever. And hope that we can get that chart filled in really quick. Vacation Bible School is a big deal for us around here and has been for a long time. And it's been a great outreach to our community. I brought, any kids recognize what this is? It needs to be bigger. This is a can of silly string. This is a really important part of our Vacation Bible School, in case you're wondering. If I were to work it out where, I'll just say it this way. We always have a attendance contest. And the class that brings the most visitors through the week, on Thursday night, they get to squirt down. Every one of those kids in that class gets a can of silly string, and they get to squirt down Count BBS. And it's a big, big deal. And I know there are some adults who would want to get involved in that too. But, in fact, some adults do. They go out and buy their own cans and come over here and squirt around them. But I just want to let you young people know, students and also adults, that we're starting Monday night counting those visitors. And every time that visitor comes through the week, it counts one more point. And the class that has the most visitors through the week, on Thursday night, we get a can for every one of them. And, man, Count BBS is just, talk about covered up. Can you imagine 25, 30 cans of silly string coming at you at one time? It's an impressive sight. And know you want to be involved. Anyway, sign up. We're registering students and all, too. Let's get into our lesson today. A couple weeks ago, I thought I would be doing something different than what we actually are doing today. But I began to hear from one place, one family after another, that they were going to be out of town. So I'm saying, well, let's just kind of take a break here and do something else for today. And I want to talk. I want to start in Matthew chapter 22. In Matthew 22, Jesus is confronted by Pharisees and Sadducees, Jewish rulers, with four questions. And those questions were all designed to put Jesus in a bad spot, a place where he would not be able to respond and give a good answer that would make sense and maybe get him in trouble with the people. Jesus came back every time he was able to answer those questions or defend them off. And then we come over to chapter 23. This is just a day or two or maybe 3 or 4 days before Jesus is arrested and tried and put on a cross. This is his last visit to Jerusalem. And he says some things to the Pharisees, and he uses a tone of voice that we have not seen anywhere else in the Gospels. It's like Jesus was saving his powder until this moment. And in Matthew chapter 23, there are seven woes that are pronounced that Jesus pronounces against the scribes and the Pharisees. And there's one of them in particular I'm interested in, and that's the one that's up on the screen there. Matthew 23:29-33. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous. And you say, if we had lived in the days of our ancestors, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Go ahead then and complete what your ancestors started. You snakes, you brood of vipers, how will you escape being condemned to hell? Man, those are strong words. And I can just imagine the tone of voice that's going on. It's not wrong to get mad. But you got to be careful when you get mad that you don't say stuff you don't mean, and that it's really right on target. It's what the person needs. I mean, there's a loving way of being mad and getting your point across. I believe Jesus was able to handle this in such a way that they got the point they needed, exactly what he heard. But Jesus is not angry with these Pharisees and Sadducees because they had built tombs for the prophets and because they honored the prophets. What he was mad about is that it was an empty kind of honor, an empty kind of praise, so to speak. And he gets right down to the point. He says, you know, you say that if you'd lived back in those days when Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, whatever, when those prophets lived, you wouldn't have participated in the stoning. But your fathers did. And Jesus is standing there, and he says, you're just like your fathers. And Jesus is standing there as a prophet of God. At the very least, he is a prophet of God. Even in the minds of these people right here, he totally baffles them. He's doing things that no one else can do. He is teaching things that a prophet would. New revelation is coming from him. And in the case of Jesus and in the case of John the Baptist, these people, the people Jesus is talking to, were ready to put them to death. And in fact, in just 2 or 3 days, they're going to be calling out, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And who is it? At the very least, he's a prophet of God. And so it's such total hypocrisy to go to the tombs of the prophets and lay their flowers down however it is that they honored those prophets, and to say, you know, if we'd lived back in those days, we wouldn't have done that to Jeremiah. We wouldn't have done that to Ezekiel. It's so fakey because they've already done it to John the Baptist. They were just very happy to see his head roll. And they're about to put Jesus on a cross in just 2 or 3 days. And Jesus says, you guys are just like your fathers. You think you're different, but you're just like your fathers. It's an empty sort of honor that you pay to the prophets of God. The reason I'm talking about this is because it's Memorial Day, or very close to Memorial Day. Tomorrow is Memorial Day. And that's a day of honoring the dead. And in some cases, the honor that will be paid tomorrow will be kind of a false or empty kind of honor. There'll be things said, the people will go and do things, but at the bottom line is their heart will not be in it, and it will be a false and empty kind of honor. They'll go through Memorial Day and not really get it. They'll not really get the point. I want to talk about Memorial Day for a little while, or the idea of honoring the dead, and just say a few words about Memorial Day. The origins of Memorial Day, I guess people have always had some kind of honor that they paid to the dead. But our modern-day version of Memorial Day probably could be traced back to just after the time of the Civil War. And that was a horrible time, and there were thousands. I don't want to say hundreds of thousands, but I think that's probably right. Hundreds of thousands of men and women who gave their lives in that conflict. It was a horrible thing for a war, for a nation to go to war against itself. But after that war was over, people began to go to the graves of these people. This would go back to 1866, 1867, and to tend those graves, to pay honor and around the last of May when the flowers are blooming. There are about 25 or 26 different places in the United States that claim to be the place of origin for Memorial Day, or Decoration Day, as it was called then. And who knows? No one's really able to sort it out. It kind of spontaneously happened after the war. People felt the need to do that. And when World War I rolled around, the whole idea of this honoring of the dead was expanded to include all veterans, all those who had died in the war. And now it's kind of includes all of those who have gone on before us. It's a time for us to stop and think not just about those who have served in the military and given their lives, but we think about all of our people who have gone before us. And it's a fitting thing to do because we stand on the shoulders of all the previous generations, of their sacrifice and of their effort and of their accomplishment. And I think about just the fact that this congregation exists. In next year, we are going to be celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of this congregation. And if you go back those 100 years and you think about what it has taken from the time of 1912, when this congregation, I don't know the exact month or whatever, but from 1912 until now, think about the sacrifices that have been made to make it possible for us to be here today as a congregation, worshiping the Lord and doing the things that we're doing, to have the facilities that we have. There's been a tremendous amount of sacrifice. We're standing on their shoulders. It's fitting that we remember those people. It's fitting that we remember the members of our family. But for a few moments, I want you to think about how we honor the dead. At the very time of their death, we have this thing called the funeral. It's a service where we take some time and we pay homage to that person. There are flowers, there's eulogies, there's people who come to visit from far away, and people who come who maybe haven't been around for quite a while. We put nice clothing on the body of the deceased. We buy a headstone. We give memorial gifts to some kind of a charity or whatever in the name of that person. Those are the things we do right around the time that a person dies. And then there's this ritual that happens in the years that follow, because around this time of year, a lot of people go out to the cemeteries. They find the graves of their loved ones. They clean them up. They put flowers there. They try to honor their loved ones in this way, the departed loved ones. And I think we all realize that almost all of this is done for the living. It's done to calm us down, to give us some comfort, to give us some peace. It's just something that we can do, a physical, tangible thing that we can do that makes us feel better. And it's kind of a way of saying, I loved that person, I respected that person, and I want everyone around to know it. But in terms of honoring the deceased, in a lot of ways, what we do defies all logic. It defies the common sense in almost in a lot of ways. On the day of a person's burial, they will be maybe wearing the finest clothes they've ever worn. They'll be wearing a nice set of clothes, I can guarantee you that. And there'll be more good things said about that person on that day than probably what they've heard in the last 10 years of their life. And more people will come by to visit on that day than have seen them maybe in the last 5 or 10 years. And they'll be resting in the nicest piece of furniture that they've ever owned, laid to rest in that piece of furniture. And if he or she were still alive, it'd be the happiest day of their life. But they're not there to appreciate it. They're gone. And they have no knowledge of what is being done. That's a question that comes up quite often at a funeral or sometime thereafter. Does this departed loved one, are they able to look back? Do they know what's going on here? Are they able? Is there some way they can communicate? And I don't think there's a definitive answer about that in the Bible. But there is a place. I'm going to go to two places before we get done with this lesson. In Luke chapter 16, there is it's the story of the rich man and Lazarus, and how both of those people die. Luke chapter 16, both the rich man and Lazarus die. And we get to peek behind the veil of death. And what happens there is very interesting and instructive. Apparently, the rich man is able to see back into life as it goes on. He sees his brothers. He sees them going down the same path. He wants to send someone back from the dead to talk to his brothers. And part of his torment is the fact that he knows his brothers are headed to the same place that he has gone. So for him, I say yes. But nothing is really said about whether Lazarus is able to look. All it says about him is he's being comforted in the bosom of Abraham. And it's hard for me to imagine that a loved one could go on and then be allowed to look back. I'm not talking about a Christian. I'm talking about someone who dies in the Lord, then be able to look back and see what's going on here. Somehow or the other, I don't think they could have the joy that God intends for them to have, looking back and seeing what's going on in life. And so when you read that passage, you get one idea. Now, there's another side to this that's going to come up in a little while in Hebrews chapter 12. But for now, let's just leave it there. And when we get to Hebrews chapter 12, we'll talk about it. But here's my real question today. Is there a better way to honor the dead? How would you like to be honored as you leave this life? I can tell you, I can say this for myself personally. The headstones and the flowers and the nice, clean, well-attended grave are not terribly important to me. I understand that almost all of that, is for the family and for those who are left behind. But I want to just give you three things to think about here about a better way to honor those those who are going on before us, not yet crossed the veil of death, but headed that way. And the first one is this: we need to honor people while they're living. Some of this outpouring of love and these words and all of these things that happen at the time of a person's death, some of that needs to be moved forward in time to let them know how people really feel about them. I'm looking at Mark chapter 14, verses 3 through 9. That was our scripture reading today. And Jesus, something happens with Jesus here that is kind of gives us some direction here. Mark 14, starting in verse 3. While he was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper and reclining at the table, there came a woman with an alabaster vial of very costly perfume of pure nard. And she broke the vial and poured it over his head. But some were indignantly remarking to one another, "Why has this perfume been wasted? For this perfume might have been sold for over 300 denarii and the money given to the poor." And they were scolding her. But Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why do you bother her? She has done a good deed to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you wish, you can do good to them, but you do not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for the burial. Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be spoken of in memory of her." Here's a lady who decided that rather than wait until Jesus died to tell him how much she loved him and respected him and felt, and boy, she felt about him, she came beforehand, before his death. And I don't see how she could know that the cross was just a few days away at this point. But she comes and, as Jesus says, "She has anointed me before my burial." She actually thought that the honor needed to come beforehand. It wasn't the value of the oil that impressed Jesus, although it was a costly gift that this woman made. But it was her open expression of love and faith in him, and he was impressed that she had come beforehand. Usually, we wait too long to honor the dead. When I was in Michigan, working with that congregation in Roseville, Michigan, there was a situation there that came up that is kind of unusual, at least in my mind. A lady in our congregation had contracted cancer, and it was a kind of thing where it was untreatable, and she didn't want to fight a fight, and she chose rather to just kind of let things happen as they did. But she had a son named Steve, and Steve was a likable guy, fun guy, but he's always in trouble with somebody. About 25, 26, 27, 28 years old, something like that. Not a Christian. Mother wanted desperately for him to become a Christian. He was coming to church. He was, trying things out, thinking about things. And I don't know if what impact his mother's sickness was having on him or how that all worked. But the day came that she did pass away and Steve had not become a Christian. So we're at the funeral home. It's a Tuesday night, Wednesday night, something like that. We're at the funeral home, and Steve comes up to me, and he says, there's his mother laying in the casket. And he says to me, "Could we go over to the church building? I want to be baptized into Christ." And I said, "Sure." And so me and Steve and about 25 people leave the funeral home. We go over to the church building, and I baptize him into Christ. And as I was doing this, I was thinking, why couldn't you have done this a week ago? Or 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago? Why do you wait? Why did you wait? Your mother would have loved to have seen with her own eyes and known in her own heart that you were a Christian. But you've waited. Some of the honor. Sometimes we wait to say and do the things we really need to do. We don't go ahead and make those steps. There are steps that we know we're taking. We're headed in that direction. But we put them off. We find reasons not to go ahead. But one of the things that we could do that would be such a blessing to all of us is to go ahead and pass on some of that honor now and let people know. There's a second thing we could do that would be, I think, would improve the kind of honor that we pay to those who are deceased. That is, we could honor them in the things that mattered most to them. Almost everybody in here, most of the people in this room right now are Christians. And I know that you're not particularly interested in flowers or eulogies or having a nice clean grave forevermore. What matters most to us who are Christians is that we would see our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren honor Jesus Christ. We like to think of ourselves as part of a convoy or a caravan headed for heaven, knowing that we're following someone else. I mean, that's the case with me. I'm following someone else who has headed me in that direction. I'm following along behind them. And behind me are children and grandchildren and so forth. And the thing that matters most to me in life, and I'm sure this is true of almost every Christian person in here, is that children and grandchildren and the family, to think of that caravan that's headed for glory, headed for heaven. The fourth commandment says, honor your father and mother. What does that mean? Well, it means lots of things. And the meaning changes as time goes on. To honor your father and mother, if you're 10 years old, it means to obey them. To honor your father and mother, if you're 25 years old, married, living outside your parents' house, means there's a respect you pay them that maybe you would not pay to other people. There's a friendship there. It's not you have to obey them, but they're special. And then you come to that time in life when they're needing help. And they're needing someone to kind of be involved with them to help them get the yard mowed and to get them to the doctor or whatever. To honor them means you go and help them and you take care of those things. That's what it means. But there's also something else here that I've thought about in the fourth commandment. To honor your father and mother also means to bring honor to your father and mother. And what is it that brings honor, joy, gladness to the heart of a father and mother? In Proverbs chapter 23, verses 15 and 17, a father is talking to his son. And he tells his son what would make him glad, what would make him happy, what would bring him honor. He says, my son, if your heart is wise, my own heart also will be glad. And my inmost being will rejoice when your lips speak what is right. Do not let your heart envy sinners, but live in the fear of the Lord always. And then just a few verses later in that same chapter, these words will show up. Listen to your father who begot you, and do not despise your mother when she's old. Buy truth, do not sell it. Get wisdom and instruction and understanding. The father of the righteous, what? Will greatly rejoice. Man, what makes a father, what brings honor and joy to the heart of a father? Well, it's the son or the daughter that buys truth and doesn't sell it, gets wisdom and instruction, that listens to what dad was saying. And so he goes on, the father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who sires a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her rejoice who gave birth to you. So to honor your father and mother means to bring honor to them. There's no parent who is not honored by a child who puts on Christ and lives the Christian life. I don't care even if mom and dad are not Christians. There is something good and something that brings honor to a parent when their son or their daughter or their grandson or granddaughter or whatever puts on Christ and lives the Christian life. There is an honor involved in that. And this was illustrated to me in a way in Michigan. We're at the time of EBS. It was about this time of year. And in Roseville, we lived at the edge of a community there in Roseville, which was basically low blue collar, some welfare, and quite a bit of strange things happening in the neighborhood. Little boxy houses that were rentals and built back in the 40s and the 50s. And it was kind of a starter place for new families or whatever. And it was, anyway, there were a lot of kids down in that area. We had a bus, an old bus. And before VBS, we would go down, the Saturday before VBS, we'd go through the neighborhoods there with our little flyers and some cards to sign kids up to ride the bus. And so we just, you take this street, and you take that street. And we could have signed up 10 busloads if we'd wanted to. We only had one bus, though. So we'd at least sign up until we got a busload and figure out what our route was going to be. But so we're there on Saturday before VBS. We're walking along, knocking on doors, putting flyers, handing flyers to the people there. And I had gone, the last three or four houses that I had gone to, people had not been home. And so I had left a flyer in the handle of of their screen door and walked on down the street and kept going, trying to find somebody who was home. Well, as I was going down the street, I heard this kaboom. Someone had just started up their Harley Davidson. And when you start up your Harley Davidson, and then you rev it a couple times to blow everything out, and I wasn't paying too much attention because that happens pretty often around there, but I was walking on, and all of a sudden by the street here, this guy swings right into the apron of the driveway just ahead of me, right across the sidewalk, and stops, and he's looking at me, and he's got the shades and the do-rag and the leather vest and all this kind of stuff, and don't know what it is with these guys on the Harleys. He's big, you know. He's big. You don't want to fight with him. He'd kill you. Anyway, he comes up and he's about 15, 20 feet ahead of me. And he's just sitting there looking at me. And I'm thinking, I'm not going any further. Finally, he turns the thing off. And he reaches in his pocket and he pulls out this flyer. He said, "You the guy putting the flyers in the doors?" I didn't want to say yes or no. But you can go two different directions with that question, you know. You the guy putting the flyers in the... And of course, I had a big handful. I mean, he knew I was. I said, "Yeah. I want to sign my kid up." In fact, he had two. And so I got out my cars and went over to this. This guy hopped off his motorcycle. Now, you got to understand, this guy did not impress me as a deacon from the church, okay? I don't think a Christian lifestyle had anything to do with his life. I mean, it was just, he was who he was. But he wanted his kids to go to VBS. That's my point. It's the strangest thing. I don't care how vile, how ugly, how ungodly parents are. They want their kids to know something about Jesus Christ. They want them to know the Bible. I guarantee it. And so here's this guy. He fills out the card and he says, "Okay, what time are you going to come around?" And all this. We take care of all that. My point is this. This stuff matters. What we do here matters. Not just to us. It matters to most people. When you start talking to them about their kids, it matters to them about their kids. There's no parent who is not honored by a child who lives the Christian life. And we need to honor those who are going on before us in the things that matter the most to them. That's a better kind of honor than flowers and eulogies and a clean grave. Find out what it is. And I can tell you with most people, the thing that matters to them is that my kid knows the difference between right and wrong and is doing right. And knows something about Jesus Christ and knows enough that maybe he could get to heaven. That's important. And that's an honor. Here's the third thing that we can do to prove our honor. We can honor those who have gone on before us by finishing the Christian race. I'm not talking about starting the race. I'm talking about finishing the race. And in Hebrews chapter 11, you have a long list of what we call the heroes of faith. People who by faith serve the Lord in magnificent, wonderful, incredible ways. Things that they did, ways that God used them because they put their faith and trust in Him. And then you come to Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And actually, there should not be a division right here. Because Hebrews 12 is actually just the next verses that follow Hebrews chapter 11. It's still about faith. And so he says here, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses..." Well, who's this cloud of witnesses? Well, it's all those people back here in chapter 11, all those heroes of faith, Moses and Abraham and Joseph and Daniel. You can just go right on down the line. People who by faith did great things for the Lord. That's the great cloud of witnesses. And he says, I want you to imagine for a moment. And he's kind of drawing a picture. And he said, imagine all these people in the stadium. A great cloud of witnesses. They're watching. Now, here's the other half, where the other half of the question we asked a little while ago comes into play. When you look at Luke chapter 16, you get the idea that maybe that rich man was able to see back. But you don't know about the guy who, Lazarus, who's being comforted in the bosom of Abraham. You get to Hebrews chapter 12, and it's kind of different. Because he wants us to think of all of those people who have gone on before us, Moses and Abraham and Joseph and David and all those people, as in some great stadium, and they're watching us as we run a race. Let's just read this. "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." The question that I was asking a while ago about can they see, I really don't know. Luke 16, maybe. Here, it sounds like maybe it could be. I don't know that the Bible really gives us a definitive answer about this. And the thing that always bothers me is how can they look back here and still be happy? That's the one that really trips me up. And so I can't give you a good answer on that. But here, what he's painting here is a picture of these people looking and watching them as they run this race. He's talking to people who are still alive, who are still in the race. And he says, all these people who are in the stands have finished the race, and they're now watching. They've set an example. They're cheering. They're pulling for you. They're waiting at the finish line. And they're watching you as you run this marathon. Marathon runners are people that I like to think about. It fascinates me, the people who train and run marathons and super marathons and all of that. And I remember back in the 70s, one of the Olympics, at the end of the marathon, I remember watching the last place finisher of the marathon run in the Olympics. This is back in the 70s. I don't know if it's 72 or 76 or how, which way it was. But this guy was so far behind, it was pathetic. They had already turned out the lights in the stadium. Just a few maintenance lights were on. But there was a cameraman who had stayed behind waiting for the last runner to come in. And this was like an hour, hour and a half after the race was over. The stands are empty. But that guy came into that stadium, and his legs are like rubber. And that's all he can do to stand up. And he just struggled right on. He didn't stop. He came across that finish line and he just fell flat on his face. I respect people who don't give up. You respect people who don't give up. And that's really what the Christian race is. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. And you have to find the pace that you can maintain. And you have to find a way, even though it's tough sometimes, and it's all you got to get there, that you can make it. Last night, we watched a little video clip off YouTube of the 1997 Ironman Triathlon. And the reason I was watching that is because of the finish of that race. Now, you know what the triathlon is, Ironman Triathlon. Well, the ladies have started getting into the triathlon now. And in 1997, there were two ladies who got within about 200 feet of the end of the race. And they were both just so dead tired, so shot, so spent, that neither one of them could really move their legs or stand up. It was hard to even watch them doing this. But they're bare, and finally they end up on their hands and their knees, and they are both running. They are both competing to finish fourth in the women's division in the triathlon, and they both end up crawling over the finish line, one just about 10 feet ahead of the other. But in watching that video, there was something else that was going on besides watching those women finish that race. I was watching the people along the sides here. And when those women were about to fall down, there were people along the sidelines cheering, and watching and trying to give them energy or something, telepathically or however you do it, saying, come on, you can do it. And there were people cheering and so forth. And when those ladies finally got across the finish line, got their hand across the finish line, there were people waiting for them at the finish line, and they picked them up and carried them off and began to take care of them and to replenish all that had been taken from them. But I respect people who will not quit, who know where they want to go, and they're just not going to quit, and it doesn't matter what it takes, they're going to get there. And that's what I think of when I think of that guy in the Olympics who comes in an hour and a half after everyone's gone. And I think about these two ladies here. And you know, it may take an awful lot from us to finish the Christian race. But there are loved ones along the sidelines who are cheering for us. People who have gone on before us, Christian people, who've gone on before us, and they're watching and they're cheering for us, and they want us to finish. And there's Jesus Christ waiting at the end of that thing to, I knew you could make it. And he picks us up and he carries us off and he tends to us. Some of us don't have loved ones waiting for us at the end. And what I would say to you is you need to be the one that blazes the path. You need to be the one that goes ahead and kind of gets the convoy going. Because here's what happens. When you cross the finish line, it makes it all that more important for your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren and your great-great-grandchildren to cross the finish line too, because they want to see you again. And they don't want to let you down. They want to make sure that they get there too. And so tomorrow, when we go to the graves of the cemeteries, to visit the graves of our loved ones. Some of those graves we're going to be visiting are the graves of people who are Christians. And they've gone on before us, and they're part of this great cloud of witnesses. They've set the example. They're waiting for us. They're cheering us on. Some of them will not be the graves of people waiting for us. But a lot of them will be. And they're waiting for us at the finish line. And I can't read you the verse in the Bible that says this, but this is what I believe about this. I don't think there's anything that we can do in life that would diminish heaven for anyone who's already gone on there. Regardless of, we talked about this question, can they see us? I don't think there's anything we can do to diminish their joy or their the glory of heaven for them. But there is something we can do that will increase it, that will magnify it and make it even better. Can you imagine heaven being better than what it is, sweeter than what it is? You know what will make it sweeter? For your loved ones who have gone on before, is for you to cross the finish line too and enjoy eternity with them. It just gets better. That's the only way you can make heaven better. It's for them to be with you in the presence of God for eternity. And so there is a better way to honor the dead. First of all, we can honor them while they're still living and give some of that attention and honor and words and so forth before they pass on. We can honor them in the things that matter most to them. And we can honor them most of all by finishing the Christian race and crossing the line to be with them. Have you started the race? Have you been weighed down somehow or the other? Have you gotten discouraged? Are you sitting on the sideline? Have you decided you're not going to do it? Have you been tripped up by sin? And the Lord tells us, get back in the race. Don't quit. As I said, I respect people who don't quit. And that's exactly what the Lord expects out of us. Don't quit. One foot in front of the other. And there'll come a day, there'll come a time when we'll understand that that is the most important thing, the most important decision we made in life, regardless of what we're going through now. Maybe there's someone here who's not a Christian. This would be a great day to confess your faith in Jesus Christ. And we're going to invite you, as we sing the hymn of invitation, for you to come, confess your faith before us, to be baptized in the name of Christ for the forgiveness of your sins. And also, there may be a Christian here that needs to get back in the race. Maybe something has hindered you in the race, and you understand you need to talk to us about it and ask for our prayers. Let's stand and sing our hymn of invitation.